Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 4. So did you actually find somewhere to sleep after this awful journey?
Oh, yes, I got up there. It was still raining heavens hard. I was soaked through to the skin. I walked into one place. It was like an outhouse in a Buckstown farmyard. And spread all over the floor were signallers, telephonists, the lot, all flat out and dead asleep. Nothing, no room on the floor there, not for a square inch. And eventually I opened another door, and there was a, like an ordinary sort of pocket in the wall or something, but it was full of junk, scrap that had been flung in and the door shut, and there was an old tin bath, and I just pulled all the things out of the tin bath and turned round and fell into it like this, and I went sound asleep.
It sounds very much as if you all had to forage for yourselves.
Oh, very much so. During the time we were round about Ypres, we used to catch... we'd one fellow from the North Tyne, a farmer, and he used to supervise a lot of our culinary arrangements. We collected fowls and all sorts of things, and we found a great big iron stock pot, and we had a fire going, and this thing had everything in it we could think of almost, and vegetables as well. We had a marvellous do out of that lot. But we were never... I've still got the Queen Mary box thing, you know, that they gave Princess Mary box with cigarettes and tobacco. But I never touched those. I brought those home. But when we were around about that part of the world, the Belgians used to hang tobacco in the lofts. And we'd never seen tobacco like this before, and thought, oh, this is good, ready-made smokes. So we take one of these strings of tobacco leaves down, pull the veins out, and the only thing we could think of was to roll them up and tie a piece of thread around and try and smoke them. And they were terrible. Awful.
The Queen Mary box, did you have that for the Christmas 1914?
Yeah.
Just that Christmas?
Yeah.
When was it given to you? On Christmas Day?
They came out a bit before Christmas. They were dished out in time for Christmas Day. Mine's downstairs. The usual thing, you know, it's just a little gilt box about so big with a packet of tobacco on one side and a packet of cigarettes on the other.
Anything else did you have for Christmas Day? Special?
not in the way of gifts of any sort. My uncle, who was a throat, nose and ear specialist, he invented the guillotine for the removal of tonsils. And he qualified in Edinburgh and eventually became the consultant at the RBI in Newcastle, and I wrote home to Mother on one occasion and said that I must have said this, that we can get bread now, that's being issued to us, and sometimes we can manage to buy some if we can get back anywhere from some of the farm people. The rations, of course, are tinned bully beef and McConaughey's and things. But the one thing that we're all very short of is milk. We can never get milk. So this uncle of mine sent out a case of the condensed milk in the small tins. I don't know if you ever remember condensed milk. It used to be in a large tin and a small one. Don't know if you can still buy it. But the small tin, he sent out a case, I think about 24. Well, we had condensed milk on porridge, in tea, on everything, until we just couldn't stand the sight of a tin of condensed milk. It was funny. Oh, there's another funny thing. Another uncle of mine who was a...
Ah.
Oh, yes. This uncle of mine... He was an engineer in the postal service, and eventually went to chief engineer in Carlisle, and then went assistant chief in London. But when the war broke out, he was then assistant chief in Carlisle, And he sent me, he said, you'll probably have to put up an awful lot with explosions and things. So I'm sending you a little box with some air defenders, which was a little tin box about so long, like these little boxes they used to have pen nibs in, and two little rubber studs in it. And in there were two little cone-shaped things that you stuck into your ears to protect your eardrums from gun blast. They're still in the box. I never wore them.
I was going to say, that accounts for your very good hearing today, but you didn't wear them.
I haven't got good hearing, you know. My relations here, my nephew and niece, they've got hearing like cats. Rusty or Joy can be downstairs in the kitchen, and the other one can be away up in the bedroom along here. And there'll be some sort of a remark made up there, and this one will answer it. I have the foggiest idea what they're talking about. And of course, the other problem is, of course, I've got a television set here, but the other problem is that they'll...
Can you remember that first Christmas day in the trenches? Where were you then? Christmas 1914.
Well, now, I wasn't in the trenches. We were in the trenches just before Christmas. Because I can remember I'd found myself a German water bottle, and I'd been haining my rum rations into this bottle. And it was the night I was in charge of posting the sentries. It was at Neuve Chapelle before, it was about just the week before the battle. I think I've got a photograph there. It was hard, frosty night, and I'd got a billy can on the fire step and a little charcoal brazier going, and I'd got from the water ration, I'd got some water into here, and I was putting rum from this into there. It was navy rum, you know, real Mackay. The first time I tried to drink navy rum, it nearly killed me. I'd never touched stuff like that before. But this thing, it was an egg-shaped, an aluminium egg-shaped water bottle covered with that khaki sort of covering stuff, and a nice screw up, a lovely water bottle. And I come it on there, and I always used to put my ration into that. And on this night, I was sitting there, I'd posted the sentries, and I was sitting, it was very cold, so I had this brazier going, putting rum into this. And round the traverse comes the troop officer for the night. It happened to be Teddy Joycey, who married, I don't know if you remember, a thing called the Bing Boys on Broadway, George Robey, Violet Lorraine. Teddy Joycey married Violet Lorraine. He was Lord Joycey's son or brother, whatever, but he was one of our troop officers, Teddy Joycey. And he came along and said, "Hello, James, what have you got there?" As if I didn't know. Sniffing hard, I said, "Just some water, sir, and a little bit of something to liven it up." He said, "Well, do you mind if I sit down and join you?" I said, "Not at all. You're very welcome." If I poured him, had a couple of aluminium pot cups, you know, poured him out a noggin of hot rum, and he very much enjoyed it. And one of my other experiences on that front, we were again withdrawn before the Neuve Chapelle battle. We'd done a period in, and then the guards came over and took over from us, and they carried out the attack. But what we were sent to do at that time was to go out on listening patrols. So I had to go out and crawl through our wire, a gap in our wire, get out into no man's land, and crawl as near as I could to the German trenches and see if I could detect anything or hear anything. What they thought I could find out, I really don't know, because we never could speak German, and the Germans could very often speak English very well. So we were at a bit of a dead loss. But I can remember getting on my... I had a patrol on another occasion getting out like that, and on our right we had the Scots Guards, and cutting across our front line was a ditch, I'd got into this ditch and I was working along towards it, and suddenly I heard a noise coming towards me, you see, so I stopped and froze and waited, and then challenged, and it turned out to be a Scots Guard sergeant who was coming back the other way. We nearly shot each other, but he said, right, you better get back, corporal, otherwise you're going to be a bit late, you know, patrols ought to be in by now. And he looked at his luminous watch, and I'd got nearly up to the hour when suddenly somebody had said, oh, all the patrols are in, and the machine guns started. They used to start off and sweep the parapet on the other side, you know, and the others would open up and do the same thing. We had to lie flat like this on the ground while all this sort of played across the top of us, and trust the luck they didn't depress at all. But we got in without being damaged.
I suppose that sometimes happened, though, that you were shot by your own side, that men were shot.
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah, quite. You see, I think in many ways, communication wasn't as good as it ought to be. The passing of information wasn't as perfected as it should have been. And they've proved since, of course, that putting people in the picture is very important. You can get far more out of people if you explain what you're going to do, take them through the thing, and then get their cooperation. You can't if you just give them orders. And that was much too prevalent at the beginning. In the early days of the war, I think there was too little cooperation and too much just dictation. It wasn't good.
Did it change as the war progressed?
Oh, yes, it did. I don't know what happened in other units, but in our units we would get everybody together, all the numbers one, in a battery, you see. You had a number one in charge of every gun, sergeant. Or telephonists if you're going out on a jaunt. But you get them all in and say, now this and this and this is the position. Explain the whole thing to them. Right. Got it all clear? Right. Now go and tell your squad. And they would go off to their gun crews and explain the whole situation to them. If it was a question of telephonists, at Vimy, when we'd taken the ridge and we'd gone down and we got ourselves established, and the front line was very chaotic. Nobody knew where the front line was, and we were responsible for putting down an SOS barrage, you see, the usual curtain that, if the infantry put up a certain very light, we knew that there was an attack being developed and we'd put down a barrage straight away. Those were pre-arranged set pieces. Well, before you did that, you had to know where your posts were. And almost invariably, in a battle like that, before a trench was developed, it would be a series of posts that had to be linked up. And after Vimy, the thing was very much in the air. Nobody knew where they were, and on that occasion I was sent up. Drew said, go on, Jimmy, you make a nice corpse, it's a fine dig, take your body up there. I want to find out, we were the only battery there, we were 1,000 miles from the front line, and we were the first communication that went anywhere backwards at that time. I'll tell you, if you remind me, I'll tell you an interesting little sideline about that. So I was sent to find out where our front line was, to send back information on which they could base their SOS barrages for the whole brigade, for the whole artillery grouping, in fact. And so that's what I did. Now, in order to get up there in the first place, it was a bright, fine day when I went off about 5 PM, and Germans were shelling the place a bit, so I said to my... I had two telephonists and a linesman, myself. I said, right, it's a bit of a leapfrog job, this. Run to that shell hole, and when you got in there, I'll send the next one off. And when we get two in there, you go on to the next one, and we'll beetle off into there. You see, I was third man in all this. So we were leapfrogging across and waiting till the shell bursts gave us a chance, and off we'd run for holes, and trust to luck they didn't land in ours. And eventually we got down to this sunk road, and I joined the battalion commander, and I said, look, Colonel, we have no idea where your front posts are, and all our people behind can do nothing for you until I do know and I can send that back. Well, he said, roughly this, so and so and so and so, and he showed me on the map. But he said, my company commanders will be the best people. So I said, right, do you mind if I go and talk to them? Nope. So off I went, crawling forward, and got up to the company commanders, and I said, where have you got your posts fixed? And he said, right, I'll come and show you. And we crawled out a bit, and he said, there's one there, and I said, here and there, you think, yes. And I gradually got these sorted out onto the map. And then I drew a tracing of this on the map, and I took it back, gave it to the linesman, and I said, take that back to the major and say, this is the information he was asking for, that's what he'd sent me for, primarily, although I was doing a 24-hour spell of duty there anyhow. But he said, find out first of all, so we just know exactly what's what. Well, I sent this sketch back to the major so that they could then plot their lines for the night, and the whole brigade would then get the information. Then during the things were pretty quiet that night. During the next day, the battalion commander said, I've got to move over to the right gunner. He said, the battalion commander on my right flank, he has been killed, and there have quite a lot of casualties have taken place. He said, I've got to take over the command of the lot, and I've got to move from here to another place further along, and he showed me on the map. So I said, well, Colonel, it's not much good my coming with you. I said, I've got lines run out from here, and I'm in contact now. We've got information running now. If anything happens, we're in contact. If I came with you, we'd both be in the midair. What I'll do is I'll send one of my telephonists with you. When he gets to wherever you're going to be located, you'd say, right, old boy, off you go, and he can go back from you to the battery and run a line from there. When they ring through to me and tell me that contact has been made, I will then come over to you. But in the meantime, I'm staying here. Because in the meantime, I'm in touch with your company commanders, which is what you are not until you settle. I'm also in touch with things that are going on and can be more use here at the moment. Right, Hope? So that was what we agreed to do. In the meantime, I went off again to the company commanders and I said, look, your BC has gone off to a new location. He'll be getting in touch with you presently, but if there's anything happening, anything you want, I'm the only saviour. Get in touch with me. I've got all the lines going. And then when he'd gone, I got hold of one of my telephonists and I said, look, there are a whole lot of loose wires running into this place. It was only a little bit of a funk hole dug into the side of the bank of this sunk road. I said, find out who's on the other end of all those if you can. Well, we unearthed a heavy battery, and we unearthed another artillery brigade, and we unearthed another reserve troop battalion of some sort, infantry unit. And so I said, righto. I got onto a, I put a telephone onto each one in turn. I said, look, I'm the brigade FO at this point. I'm the only communication at the moment. We've only got one telephone. If the balloon goes up, my bloke will put a telephone onto you and just buzz, and that's something for you to do straight away. With the heavies, it was all right. I said, if we buzz for you, well, you've got to just open up with everything you've got, because we'll need it. There's an attack on. And I said, if that happens, then we won't have time to do more than just broop, and you'll have to go off. Keep somebody on your end of the wire all the time, because we won't be able to. We've one telephone. So I fixed that up with all these bits going inside. And then I went off to the company commanders again, told them what was what, and we'd got all this extra support lined up. And in the middle of the next night, Jerry attacked us. One of the platoon guys came along to me and said, here, there's a rifle and a couple of grenades. You might need those at any minute. I said, look, if I can't use this telephone, these aren't going to be any good to you or me. I said, they can shoot me up as much as they like here, but I've got to listen to this. So he said, righto, we'll see what we can do to look after you. So when this balloon went up, I just said to my blokes, right, get busy, and they just put this telephone on, and they buzz, buzz, buzz. We had an absolute curtain of fire went down from there, and it wiped the whole counterattack up completely. The brigadier came up to the battery position next day. I was about due to be relieved, matter of fact, by that time. But the brigadier came up to the battery position next day to personally thank me for all the help I'd given his battalion commander. And I recommended my two linesmen who'd kept my lines going all the time, broken with shell fire and mended, and broken in shell fire and mended again. I recommended them both for military medals for what they'd done, and they got them. When I got back, the adjutant told me I'd been put in for a military cross. As it happened, we were moved from there. Army brigades, you know, nobody's children. We were shunted from there up to the coast. We weren't there very long. We were shunted to Italy. It wasn't until we came back from Italy that my gong came through orders. You know, he bounced about and about. Now, the result of it was, the thing that upsets me rather, is that the citation which I would have got at that time was forgotten. All I got was a military cross, which I was rather fed up about. Particularly as, here is the thing I was going to tell you, which is funny. I went on this trip to Vimy with the, what do you call it? There were four fellows there who'd been in World War One. One of them was a regimental sergeant major of artillery who'd gone out as a replacement RSM to the 7th Division in 1915. He had come from Canada. After the war, he was the only one there in a wheelchair, as a matter of fact. After the war, he'd gone back to Canada. And he'd spent long years in there, but he'd come back now and again to this country, and he was on this trip with us. And while we were on this trip to Vimy, after we'd John Giles, after he'd talked about the attack and everything, he said, "Well, now we've got somebody here who took part in this show, and he could probably tell you a little bit about his own personal experience." So I recounted our move there, and the conditions of things, and what we'd done, getting guns down the face of this ridge and so forth in the middle of the night, and about the attack and the communications. And when it was all over, this bloke jumped up and said, "Just a minute, John," this was John Giles, the conductor, he said, "Just a minute, John, before you go any further, I can vouch for everything that Jameson has just told you." And he said, "I'll tell you why. As you know, I've been in Canada, and we've got a lot of ex-service associations there, and I attended one where a Canadian came and talked to us about this battle, and he's told me almost word for word just exactly what Jameson has just told you." Now, that was years after, at an ex-service do in Canada, coming around through this fella to this coach trip a year ago. Cranes, isn't it?
It's because Vimy would have been a bit later on in the war, wouldn't it?
Hmm?
Can you remember the date of that battle?
Yes, 17 about, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you would have been an officer then, of course,
oh, yeah.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I think you ought to tell us at a later stage about the attack as well as the communication story,
yeah,
because that was very interesting. Mm. Communications, of course, were very important, I would think, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. From an artillery point of view, you couldn't operate without them, because you couldn't. There was nowhere where you could signal. It had to be by telephone. You got into a hole on the ground somewhere, as at Vimy, where you crawled in. They did a lot of tunneling there. And you crawled in these tunnels and went up an air vent and stuck a spade in, and for a point where you could see the German wire from, you see, and you'd sit up there and range on the wire to cut that wire to pieces in preparation for an attack. It was a bit of a fallacy of the higher command that that field batteries could cut wire, but they couldn't, you know. Never did. I mean, if you did, what happened? You ripped up a bit of the wire and the stuff rolled up in bundles like that. It was more dangerous even than if it was not. Much easier to chuck somebody's top coat over the top and roll over it.
And yet still they persisted with that strategy of trying to chop it up with fire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They got some queer ideas. We had another queer idea later when we got onto the Ransart area where there was an enfilade sort of running half across the front line and the German front line. They got the idea that German tanks might be able to come down that, so they would detach a battery and they would take up a couple of guns and drop into a position just short of our front line, fire out a few rounds into this gully and dash away again just to warn the Germans of what might happen if they tried it. Well, of course, that was all right as far as it sounded, but we galloped up there with a couple of guns. Action front, down came the trails, and we fired off these rounds, limbered up, and off we went again. We were most unpopular with the infantry because they got shelled after we'd gone. Don't let those so-and-sos come back here. We don't want them. We didn't want to go. And as a matter of fact, it was a mixed thing altogether because we were where we were lying out was alongside a guard's training area, and the Germans bombed that one night. We counted the bombs that came down, waiting for the last one. The small ones that fell were instant detonation things, which just cut everything off at about 2 feet high, you see. We were living in tents, but in graves. So that when they dropped, we heard these bonk, 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 our horse lines away up the hedge here, and the guards just over there, and they killed a whole lot of guards in this area. And we waited for the last one to come, and it didn't come, and then suddenly we heard it, and it was a big one. But as it happened, this bit of ground was grass, and then beyond it, beyond our trenches, was plough, and fell in the plough. I've got photographs in there. A hole about 60 feet wide and about 20 feet deep. Photographed these fellows sitting on the other side of it. If that had been a small one, it would have cut us to pieces, but being a big one, it went right into the ground and blew all the stuff in the air. It all fell on our tents and they collapsed. So we were covered in clods of earth and stuff, but no more damage. But the horses went all over the country. It took us 2 days to find our battery horses again. They'd broken the head ropes and vanished.